C1A. Number 19A.
Well, we started with love as soul, showing how love, never losing sight of loveliness, love never being disunited with her idea, therefore never being disunited with soul, how therefore love always draws spiritual selfhood, sinless selfhood to herself, and she only can do that while material selfhood is seen as nothing, is driven to nothing, usually driven through suffering to nothing. Now, how does she develop this sense? Again, from a proposition up to its full glory. How does that law operate in consciousness? It always begins to operate first at the point of mind or thinking. And so here she says first the belief of sin and self must yield to the recognition of idea of a spiritual self. There it starts all. Always something starts with first recognizing what is an illusion or a belief and what is true idea about it. Start therefore first to see that we must see the true idea of spiritual selfhood and see that spiritual selfhood never suffers and that all that suffers is the belief in a material self. So how can we be saved from suffering? First by seeing that our true selfhood is ideational and that it isn't something which has to do with a material self. Therefore, the second point is at once that therefore the spiritual selfhood must overcome the material selfhood. So we get the touch of spirit that the spiritual self must overcome and triumph over sin and self. There where it says that we must overcome the world, the flesh and all else. See, it's again universal. It doesn't say we must overcome our fleshly problems. So it's all flesh, all error, the whole world. Just overcoming the belief that sin and self has anything to do with a universal concept and belief in matter. Then, in that demand of triumphing over the spiritual selfhood, we come to the touch of soul, showing that we reach that spiritual selfhood or immortality, but we reach that only really through immortality and never through succumbing to mortality, death, or the grave. Human mind says, if I die, I get into immortality. I am ushered in into immortality. If I die and my body is laid into a grave, then my soul resurrects itself to its spiritual identity. And so she corrects that and says, that's not the way. The way is that only mortality ushers in immortality, and that therefore never mortality, death or the grave can usher in immortality. Therefore death, she says, is not the stepping stone out of mortality into immortality. Then the touch of principle, where she says that this salvation is possible here and now. Through what? Through a scientific apprehension, and not through any so-called sciences or sense apprehension. Here she gets that tone which we so often get in principle, science versus sense. Science testimony versus sense testimony. Here she says, oh, I thought somebody was saying something. She shows here that we must get the true idea of the divine principle of all that really exists, and that salvation is apprehended through science and not sense. So it is in that translation sense, from sense to soul, from material selfhood to spiritual selfhood, in that translatory period comes the point of principle where principle steps in and says, I help you in that translatory period if you base yourself on a science instead of basing yourself on the sense testimony. Get the ideational interpretation of your spiritual selfhood and not the sense interpretation of yourself. We need that so much. See, we need that so much that so we are just always beclouded, really. When we pray and commune with the one God, when we commune with the true idea of man, when we commune now in soul, say, with our true spiritual selfhood, and begin to realize that true spiritual selfhood first is ideational, that it has only to do with ideas, that it hasn't to do with belief. Second, that our in communing with our true spiritual selfhood, we see that it is standing high above the material, the world, the flesh, untouched by the world, the flesh, and error. And that this ideational spiritual selfhood is immortal, and therefore does not to become immortal through a death or through the grave, but is already immortal, that's the third. That then we must counteract all the suggestions of the sense testimonies, which says, but, and rely and face ourselves that what we have seen in these first three statutes, that is the principle of our true selfhood, the principal sense of our true selfhood, and rely on that, and not deviate from that. And then she goes to the touch of life, and as you can be sure, when it comes to life, we get some sacrifice. And so here she says, without the scientific apprehension, we practice sin, and hence support sin. Consequently, if we want to stop the false sense of our true selfhood, that we jolly well have to stop and give up a false sense of ourselves. We have to stop the belief in sin, and then we stop the practice of sin. She says, remove error from thought, and then we remove its effect. So again, it is laying down, sacrificing the belief in sin, and then we don't practice sin, and so really the exaltation begins to take place. Then in truth it says, and by doing that, by removing sin, we remove also the penalty, the effect of sin, due for sin. That's what it says, I understand, to be the divine part. See, now, always in truth we get the answer, you know, we come to the true form, to the true consciousness of a proposition. And so here we come to the removal of the penalty due for sin. And lastly, in love, is that in this endeavor to abandon sin, we can already enjoy in anticipation of triumph, in spite of the suffering which is involved in the transitionary state. Shows there what we should remind more and more and more, that while this transition from sense-soul goes on, that in that transition through which suffering and sin is cleansed, that we should see what is behind it. Behind it is love. Behind it is love that says, I am love. I just don't allow anything else to come into the Holy of Holies but sinlessness, spiritual self. And therefore I must cleanse every love of sin. Therefore I must destroy every belief in pleasures and pains of the senses. Love says, that's my loveliest thing I can do, that I force a material sense to give itself up. But because we can see the science of its behind it, I would say at least the order, law behind it, we can see, well, if I go through those transitionary periods of being weaned away from sense and sin, of weaned away from material sense, which is always coupled with sorrow and victories and defeats and so on, I can say, but behind it is that wonderful love which draws me to herself, and therefore I should rejoice in anticipation, really, of what's coming. That I can go through the triumphal arc of love. That all that which is happening in that sense, in that way, from sense to soul, is not a bad experience. We always think we go through a bad experience instead through a lovely experience. Because love is at the helm of every love. Never knew the sight of loveliness. It's love, law, and purpose, and intent to save us from sense, sin, mortality, selfishness, material selfhood, all that which is the counterfeit of soul. And in that cleansing period, we go through what we call suffering, and the sorrow and defeat and triumph and so on. But behind it is love. And if we are scientists, and only that's why it comes in and says, rely on the true idea behind it, and not on the sense testimony. Rely on the true idea behind it, we can already see the silver lining of the whole experience. That it leads us step by step nearer to the triumphal arc of truth and love. That stone of love as soul. Can you see how behind it is that forcible purpose of love which says, I'm salvation, I'm the day of salvation, and therefore I bring everybody to salvation, all to salvation. Now, if you take the next one, love as principle, if you go through the tone of love, you find quite different aspects of love in this tone. She usually speaks here about peace and about rest, about the Shekinah. The Shekinah is a word which one commentary explains as God's abiding presence among his people through his glory. See again that presence of love, that calmness of love, that holy of holiest, that the side note was within the veil. What was within the veil was the holiest of holiest. It's that peace and rest, Shekinah. Also, he speaks here about the completed earthly mission and the fulfilled God mission. You see, again, you come to the point of rest where you sit down at the right hand of the Father, sits there. See, quite a different touch of love. Can you see that? How she varies these tones. No, she didn't vary them. God varied them, and she listened and obeyed and wrote it down. If you read this passage through and see what is the principle, the tone of principle, it's always about proof and demonstration of doing good deeds, proving divinely and scientifically, and so on. Again, everything that is personal and so on. Again, you look back, what was the fourth main subject which we had in Atonement and Eucharist? You remember what it was? So that principle demanded there adherence to a scientific sense of atonement which alone has spiritual power and which alone conserves spiritual power. That's what we had yesterday, remember. It had the same tone of principle as here, namely as principle in its office of the Christ, namely as operative demonstrative power. But here it is shown from the absolute, from the subjective sense of love, showing love never loses sight of loveliness. What is that loveliness? Our loveliness here is principle. So love never loses sight of the ever-operative principle. And therefore it is love that rests in action and that acts in rest and peace. That's what we get. That truth, how did I put my epitome? I said here that love demands that we prove the divine principle to be love by giving the proofs of love. If you read it through, you feel that touch very much, that love rests in act, and that love acts her rest. And therefore, that it translates itself, as the Christ chapters always do, they always translate, and show that really true love, the signs of true love are given through holy acts. That's what we find here. Giving the proof of love by principled acts. How? Says, we must give the proof of love by what signs? What are the signs of love in principle? By daily deeds. She compares it with divine service, with just public worship and personal worship, and says, no, divine service really should be daily deeds. So we show our love in deeds, our proof of love. Giving the proof of love here is gives the proof that we act according to a principle. And this principle says, I'm mine, therefore I'm deed. I'm active through actual deeds, daily deeds. Then as spirit, we give the proof of love by what? By departing actually from material sense into the spiritual sense of deed. If we want to show, if we exemplify love principle as act, then here as spirit we act in that way that we depart actually from material sense and cast our hope, beyond the veil of matter into the Shekinah. It is casting our hope beyond the veil of matter, to advance beyond matter. In that act, we prove our love. If we don't advance in that direction, if we like to advance into the direction of better matter, better human standards, and so on, as the purpose and motive of love, not as the effect of it, but as the motive and purpose of love, we give no proof of love. Not a bit. Soul agrees. Here shows in that we see the love, that we give the proof of love by departing from material things and casting all our ambition, all our desire, all our heart, all our purpose of life into the scale of the spiritual. Then goes the soul and says, and in this endeavor, really, we should be calm and steadfast, giving the proof of love by walking calmly on, trusting the golden rule, though with bleeding footsteps, which gives a proof that we really love God if we don't go back. If we walk really calmly on and don't shrink, go back, but walk calmly on, though with bleeding footprints. Jesus did it, and his whole purpose was love. His whole purpose was not anything else but show that God is unchanging love, and therefore change, and therefore love asks us not to change our loving pathway. That once we have started to act mind, to act in what direction? Spirit, which says, out of material sense into the Shekinah, beyond the veil of man. It says, that is shown, then is shown our love that we reflect soul as steadfast, walking calmly on, not going back. And then we come to principle, and again we get the touch of science, and we give the proof of love, she says, by healing through science. The accent is not healing, but science. Healing through science, and not healing through the theories of any school of philosophy or materia medica or scholastic theology or anything like that. Science, again, just as we had the subtone before in soul. We give proof of our love if we put all our love and trust in science instead of science. And then life says we are giving the proof of love by not shrinking from fulfilling God's mission, no matter what the cost. That he shows here that the disciples went on, still going on doing good deeds, in spite of persecution, of being maligned, of being stoned. Herein we show our love. See how Christian science is not a mental science. Can you see? I think that becomes clear and clear. A Christian science is not a mental science. Mentally we can do all sorts of, so easy to wander around mentally from one stage to the other, from one plane of mentality to another plane of mentality. So easy. But when it comes to true Christian, then it's not only mind, it's also spirit. It's spiritual experience of purity and effect. It's also soul, where we inwardly and steadfastly have to use the persistency and perseverance of soul. And it's also principle, where we jolly well have to investigate the science of these things and not just rely on some people's interpretation and doctrines and aspects and opinions. And then it's always that science which is influenced by life, the Christian science living, where it's shown, well, we have to stick to that what we see is right, spite of every sacrifice we have to make. Therein will be shown our love. No sacrifice is big enough to hold us back. That being stoned and maligned, persecuted and misrepresented just has no effect on us. If our love for science is big enough, then all these aspects of being persecuted and misrepresented and maligned and so on just fall by the wayside. But that therein is the proof if we can do it. Everyone can test himself. And if we give that proof, then in truth we see that then we practice the truth, even if it is ridiculed by the world. We jolly well practice that. And so in love, it shows that giving the proof of love is proving through our life that God unchanging love. He says that Jesus proved divinely and scientifically that God is unchanging love, whereas the Jewish God was a mighty potentate, love and hate. So we can inwardly test ourselves how much love we have to this divine prince. If we really always love, or if we love a lot and hate a little, the moment we are no more unchangingly expressed in giving the proof of unchanging love, we have tested ourselves that we have not complied with atone, with the prickly love prince. Well, that's that. So you see how here love never loses sight of prince, and in doing that draws to herself everything that is printed, and therefore demands proof of that love in giving the proof that we rely on the divine prince. Now let me take the last stone, the love of life. I take it for the last few minutes, though it is really a shame that I do. That stone is so big, it's so powerful. One could stay over it, and I did stay over it for weeks, and I bet you will do it too. And once you touch that tone of lover's life, it just doesn't leave one anymore. But after all, it's an individual birth, and even if I would go on talking and talking for hours, just talk, not the birth. So I don't mind really very much, a little bit I do mind, but I don't mind too much that I have to go over it too quick. The tone of love in here, here it is, shown again in a different sense. You read it through and ask yourself, what is the tone of love in it? Shown as the unity of God and man, as the unbreakable inseparability, really, of God and man, that man cannot be separate from God. You see that intimate unity of God and man, of man's intimate coexistence, so to say, with God, the indivisibility of God and man. That's the tone of love. See, love never loses sight of loveliness. Here it is in that way love, that love gives us a sense. Love is never separate from its presence.